Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is New Paltz resident Joel Goldstein, who works as a transportation and logistics executive. The founding president of Southern Ulster YMCA, Goldstein is an adoption advocate who has adopted two children. Goldstein is the author of No Stone Unturned, which chronicles the story of his son, Bart Goldstein, and his long recovery from traumatic brain injury after a 2001 car accident. Joel Goldstein, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Alan. It's a pleasure and an honor, I must say, to be here.
So let's start. When did this accident happen?
It happened on December 29th, 2001. So we're going on 11 years now.
And how old was your child?
16.
Yeah. And what were the repercussions? Do you remember the night that the call that every parent fears the most in their life happened?
Sure. I wish I could forget it, but I remember it very clearly. We had been to a Christmas party. We had our 11-year-old daughter with us. We got home, and we were expecting Bart to be there along with three or four of his friends for a sleepover, but he wasn't there. And there was a note, a little scrawled note, saying, "Hey, you know, I've gone to George's for the night." We thought nothing of it because sleepovers are a way of life, especially in rural upstate New York. But there was a message on the machine, and I thought of not even answering it because it was Christmas. I said, "Ah, the hell with it." But I did. I answered it. It was a police lieutenant in New Paltz. He was very vague. "Just call right away. Your son's been in an accident." And then, frankly, we had a hard time reaching him. He was busy, and no one else would speak to us. But eventually we got someone who said, "Your son is at Westchester Medical Center. He's been in an awful accident." And that's all they could tell us. So naturally we, you know, I grabbed a sack. I have a sack ready for last-minute business trips. I grabbed the sack. I told Dale, "Throw some things." Dale's my wife, Dale Gradine. And we arranged for babysitting. And, you know, we were in a grim mood, but no particular expectations. We didn't know he had traumatic brain injury. We didn't know his status. It's 11 years ago. We barely had a cell phone. We had one of those track phones. We have good phones now. And we set off for the hospital. We couldn't reach anybody at the hospital. We knew nothing, really, other than he was there. And we were wondering, I mean, there's five hospitals within 15 or 20 minutes, fast drive from New Paltz, but he was in Westchester. And we knew that wasn't good.
Westchester has a reputation as being a great rehabilitation hospital.
It's a grade one trauma center, that and Albany Medical Center. They're the ones in downstate New York. We knew that much, that it was a superior hospital, but why would he be there? So on the ride down, we managed to reach someone who, when we described Bart, said, "Well, there's a young John Doe." They didn't even know who he was.
Wow.
In emergency brain surgery. So that was awful news, and it was hard to drive the rest of the way. Real fast, and we got there.
What was going through your heads as you were driving down?
Well, you know, my mother, she's a rest in peace, was a nurse. She was only a licensed practical nurse, but she really knew an awful lot and seen an awful lot. And my sister was a just retired head nurse, an RN. So I hate hospitals. They taught us, the rest of the family, they'd always said, "Stay out of hospitals, they'll kill you." So I was terribly nervous. I actually was doing something much like a twitch, you know, kind of shaking my head to kind of bring myself out of this insanity. We got down there, and we ran into some other New Paltz parents and the kid who had been in the accident. Bart was a passenger. So We caught up, we told the hospital who Bart was, and we waited. You know, it's emergency brain surgery. It takes all night. It took about 6 hours. And then by bad luck, the surgeon went home to sleep, and no one in PACU, post-operative recovery, could tell us anything about Bart's status. They either didn't know or they knew, but they weren't permitted to tell. We had to speak to the surgeon who'd gone home to sleep. So we were stuck there with Bart, who, and this is a gospel truth, we could not, even his mother, we could not recognize Bart. We weren't sure it was him because he was completely swathed in tape and staples. And the only part of him you could see at all were his eyes, but they were shut. He was in a deep coma, induced but also natural. He was in a coma from the accident. So we weren't sure it was him, but then my wife had the bright idea of looking at his feet, and he has big hammer toes, and we recognized him. But otherwise, he was just this monstrous creature. He had tubes coming out of his mouth and nose, which you might expect, but big ones coming out of his head, right, the size of, say, battery cables coming right out of his skull. And there he was. And there was no one who could tell us anything about him or would.
How were you as a papa feeling about this? Were you angry? Were you sad? What was happening?
Well, I would say high anxiety. I wasn't angry. I didn't know. I didn't really know what had happened, and I didn't know what state Bart was in. Although I could, I mean, you could see he was in a coma. And a doctor came by and examined him and did one of those open the eyes and shine a little flashlight in. And she said, again, she wouldn't tell us anything. She was just on duty, but I could read her. I've been around the block. I'm not a kid. I could see in her eyes that she wasn't pleased with his pupil reaction or lack of reaction. So later that morning, we ran into one doctor who was kind enough to say to us that, well, listen, whatever happens, it's going to be a long haul for your boy. And I'm a cockeyed optimist. All of my siblings are. The whole family is that way. And I took that as good news that he was going to survive.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. Brooklyn! Yeah. Shout out to Brooklyn. But my parents are off the boat there, FOBs, fresh off the boat.
And you moved to New Paltz?
We moved to New Paltz as rock climbers. That was a lifetime ago, before the kids. Yeah. But my son is now 27 and lives in Del Mar right up here. And our daughter, Cassidy, who was 11 at the time, she's all grown up. She works. She graduated Siena College and works at the Wolf Road Marriott and is doing brilliantly there as a supervisor in food services.
We are talking to Joel Goldstein. His book is No Stone Unturned, a father's memoir of his son's encounter with traumatic brain injury. Okay, Joel, pick up the story. What
okay.
happens next?
So we got filled in a resident came by that we were hounding the administrative offices to get some clarity, just some idea of what Bart's condition was. So a resident came over. He said he'd been at the surgery, and he could fill us in. And he told us very succinctly but briefly that Bart had a massive subdural hematoma, which is a blood Leaf. Clot, yeah. Huge blood clot under the dura, in the brain, let's say, the outer shell of the brain. It had been removed. He was in very, very poor shape. He was in a deep coma with secondary ischemic injuries, that's stroke-like injuries, and might survive, but we wouldn't know for 96 hours.
Did you sleep that night?
No, in fact, we didn't sleep at all, I think, for 7 or 8 nights. And,
really?
And, you know, we weren't that tired because you're on an adrenaline rush like nothing else in life. And I was a mountain climber. I've been in avalanches. There's nothing like your son's life hanging in the balance. And so we didn't sleep. Eventually, they gave us meds. But the truth is, Alan, I haven't had a really good night's sleep since. I seem to have lost the knack.
Why did you adopt?
hey, Bob and Weave, it's a good question. Well, we wanted children. We had concerns about our ability to produce a healthy child. And,
can I ask why?
Well, my side especially had a tragic history. Both I have two siblings, mm-hmm. and they both had tragic childbirth. Not so much stillborn as worse than stillborn, living for a little while, dying, born with dread diseases and so on. So it's a crapshoot, and we wanted kids, and we always liked the idea of adopting. And so we looked at adoption, but we were mature by then. We'd been married 12 years.
And how old were the children when you adopted them?
They were babies. They were both 5 months old. Bart came 6 years before, roughly 6 years before Cassidy.
Was it difficult to go through that process? I mean, you know, finding babies is not that easy.
Well, this was 30 years ago. It was a little easier, although it wasn't easy, you know. And there's the full gamut of social work, intervention, and meddling. And then there's just the difficulty of getting kids out of a foreign country like Korea. I was getting ready to fly over to Korea. I was in the air freight business. So I had some connections that might have helped me in that connection. But when we got word that Bart was on a plane coming here, so we got everybody together, the ganze mishpacha, as they say in French, and we went to JFK and we met him. And we have it on multiple videos. He was well received and he was the apple of everybody's eye, the first grandchild on my wife's side. And it was a big fuss.
Do you remember the day you picked him up first?
Of course. Are you kidding? We call it Arrival Day, which is August 24th, 1986. And we celebrate the children's birthdays and their arrivals day. To this day, we'd be glad to stop, but they want the presents. You know?
Interesting. And your other child, Cassidy?
Cassidy came roughly 6 years later. Bart was and is a spirited child. There's a book called The Spirited Child, if you want to read about that. They're not hyperactive, but they're very, very energetic, very bright, very energetic. They boogie till they bounce. And it was like having
twins. Are they both Korean?
Both full-blooded Korean. In fact, they are uniquely unique. I always told them this growing up, but it hasn't changed, that there's no one, and this is true for every child, but more true for us, there's no one in the world like them because they're full-blooded Korean. They were raised Greek Orthodox, but with a Jewish father and name. And so they're a unique minority of two. And
you mean you're the Jewish father?
I'm the Jewish father.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Right.
But I told them that they could travel the world, they probably won't meet anybody quite like them. And I should say, Alan, that they don't, you know, people wonder, are they confused? Do they have some kind of identity complex? No, they're very comfortable in their own skins.
Pick up the story.
Well, so we found out that it was going to be a long haul. We sat by Bart's side for 30 days in coma. After a week or so, it did seem that he was going to survive. But, of course, they kept telling us about, they did additional CAT scans that were more injuries from the swelling. You know, the standard of care for TBI, for traumatic brain injury, has improved. It continues to improve. It's better now than it was then. So today, if he'd had that accident, he would have had a craniotomy. They would have removed half of his skull, and that would have reduced the damage from swelling, which can kill. And the increase in intracerebral pressures, they monitored it in those days. They had another tube in the brain just for that. And we sat and we watched the ICPs day and night, and we worried about them. And Dale has a cousin who's a distinguished physician and anesthesiologist. And we had him call the hospital every day and find out what was really happening, since really we're non-medical. And even when they tell you what's happening, you don't understand it, you know. So we had him interpret for us what was going on. And that wasn't always a comfort, because what was going on wasn't good, and his pressures were going up, and that was doing secondary damage. And in any event, he eventually, they put in a tracheotomy, they put in a peg for his gut. We resisted those things because we said, well, he'll come out of it, and how are you going to leave him? He's a teenager with big scars right on his throat, which of course he has now, but he's not a teenager, thank God. And he did begin to come out of it, and the moment you're awake at all, I mean, even for a few moments, which is all it was, they're ready to move you to rehab. So he went on to Helen Hayes Hospital.
What did you learn about the accident itself?
Okay, it's sort of like a boring story, the accident, and yet it's repeated millions of times.
Which I presume is part of the reason you wrote this book.
Well, no, we wrote the book not to tell Bart's story. I mean, Bart's story is worthy of telling, but there are 6 million people in the United States like Bart. So this is a big deal. And we want people to understand traumatic brain injury, and we'd like to see some kind of grassroots movement. Either it's nascent right now, but we'd like to see that emerge along the lines of, say, Autism Speaks. And then more importantly, because you asked me why I wrote the book. I mean, I wrote it to get it out of my system, but why did we go to the trouble of publishing, a very considerable trouble for an unpublished author? We did that so that those 6 million, we call them the Fellowship of TBI. We came up with that name when Bart was in coma. In those days, we called it the Fellowship of the Damned, but we eventually just called it the Fellowship. We want the Fellowship to know the process that we ferreted out and cobbled together in this book, and that promises them a better outcome than the one they are handed by best practices of conventional medicine. If we had followed just those best practices, Bart would be in a nursing home now, 11 years later.
I really do want to get back to that. Sounds very interesting. But let's talk a little bit about the accident for a moment.
Okay. So he's 16. He's with other friends. They're supposed to be sleeping in our house. They went to someone else's. And they all just got their license, except Bart. He talks about law of unintended consequences. We had kept him from getting his license and challenged him to earn money to buy a car, and we would match the money and he'd get a car. And he'd be a little older before he hit the roads. He hit the road in a car driven by a 16-year-old who'd been driving for 8 days, nighttime, winter, three of them in the car. They just drove into a tree. People who witnessed it said it was the stupidest thing they'd ever seen. There were no drugs or alcohol involved. What there was involved, and there's been many studies of this, was too many boisterous teenagers in a car. That's all it was. They were clowning around, and they drove into a tree. Bart's head hit the tree by wonderful luck, because, you know, my mother used to say it's good to be smart, but better to be lucky. The head of the New Paltz rescue squad, all right, Jeff Salt, happened to be there. He was a block away. He lived a block from the accident, so when the call went out, he just literally walked over with his young son. Saw Bart. He is an EMT by profession, so this is like a, you know, busman's holiday for him, but he's so experienced that he assessed Bart right there and called for the helicopter before the squad even came.
Oh, so he went immediately to Westchester.
Well, he had the squad come, but he went immediately. He saw Bart's head and took his pulse. I spoke to him much later, and he knew that Bart was dying right there and then, so he called for the helicopter. And because of his swift intervention, and because we got lucky with the surgeon who was on call that night, David Harder, who was head of pediatric neurosurgery, just by the luck of the draw, the rotation, Bart was in surgery less than 3 hours after the accident. And that's the sort of thing that you know, saves lives. So it was just boys clowning around. The two boys in the front were not really hurt because they had seat belts and airbags. Bart was in the back seat with neither.
How did Cassidy take all of this while it was going on?
Well, you know, it changed her life. At first, just like an 11-year-old would, you know, tears, and she wrote him letters. We had her write him letters even while he was in coma. But I would say Cassidy was perhaps the happiest child I've ever known. All things pleased her. The adoption agency, with whom we had a very warm relationship, we were donors and we were involved in other ways. You know, I'm an adoption activist. I ran a camp right here in Albany for years at Parsons Child and Family Center. So we had a good relationship with the head of the adoption agency. She promised us that Cassidy was so calm and serene that she would even calm Bart down. And I thought, frankly, that was nonsense. But my wife fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. It turns out she was right. Cassidy is a serene child and a serene person. But I would say in many ways it ruined Cassidy's life, as it did all of ours. The truth of the matter is, if you have a severe TBI, it's one of the most devastating injuries imaginable.
If you're just joining us, TBI is traumatic brain injury.
Right, yeah. So I'm not saying it's the worst in the world. You can come up with some other pretty bad ones, ALS and a few others, but it's hard to get much worse. And what it does to the individual and through the individual and his terrible suffering, it pretty much destroys the family. We have survived, but we had to work hard, you know, to hold tight to each other.
You're all together. Everybody's alive.
Everybody's good. Everybody. Mm-hmm. We're a loving family, but we're not what we were, and we're not going to be. We're walking wounded, and so is she.
All right. So as soon as he begins to open his eyes, they send him to rehab.
Right.
What happens then?
Well, rehab is a different kind of place, you know, where people aren't dying right and left. It's not quite the fellowship of the damned, and that's when we started calling it the fellowship. But you get to know a lot of other families. We're all in the same boat. There's a lot of teens. Some of them die. They die at the first hospital. And it is, they call it boot camp at Helen Hayes. They, even though he's hardly conscious at all, you know, coma emergence. When you watch TV, let's say you watch while you were sleeping, you know, the guy wakes up and he's a little vague, but he's there. It's not anything like that. Coma emergence goes on for weeks and months and years. And of course, as you know, because people stay in vegetative states and so on, it could stop at any stage. So he went there. He was still in early stages. He was in second stage of four stages of coma emergence. But right away, he's doing physical therapy, PT, OT, vision therapy, speech therapy, you name it. Now, he's hardly conscious. He is truly, if you were to just casually, you'd say he's a zombie. You know, the zombie craze? You go to any of these rehab hospitals, we got millions of zombies. And he was one of them. And they're working him through this. And he didn't make great progress. And in fact, after 3 months there, they threw him out. You know, there are limitations even with Medicaid, which he was on by then, limitations on how long you can stay in a hospital. So he went to day hospital, visiting hospital. He would go there for rehab. But even after 9 months, he truly was that kind of walking, like the Walking Dead. He could walk, he could talk a little, but barely. He could hardly make sense. And he had once been literally the class clown. He was elected class clown in middle school. He was at a stage after 9 months, he couldn't understand even the simplest joke. He couldn't understand a simple expression like, he got up on the wrong side of the bed. He just looked puzzled.
What was his relationship with you guys like?
Well, it varied. He clung to us as somebody familiar, although not right away. When he got to Helen Hayes, he was beginning to really wake up. So we went home and we came back the next day. And he was truly awake, but completely freaked out of his mind and did not recognize us.
When you say freaked out, what do you mean?
Just in a horror. He couldn't speak, so you'd read it in his eyes and expression. He was not speaking. He started speaking about 2.5 months after the accident. It was not that he had aphasia. He had a trach in his throat, and he couldn't speak. They didn't know if he ever would speak. But when the trach comes out, that's the test. And they say if you pass the test, you curse like a drunken sailor. So he passed with flying colors. And we knew. I never doubted he would speak because he was and is a funny, sociable, you know, extreme extrovert. He's the guy. He was the guy who would have won most outrageous in high school.
So what were the parental roles as he got home?
Well, you learn to walk on eggshells, I can tell you that, because one of the features of severe TBI, almost universal, but nothing is universal. Not, you know, take aspirin, does it work for everybody? No. Were, you know, what you'd call anger management issues. Bar could fly off the handle at the least little thing. What did it sound like?
Yeah.
Well, I can't really say on the air what it sounded like because the cursing didn't necessarily stop like that. The typical example would be he'd say something, but he was mumbling, and half the time he was saying nonsense. So you'd say, "What's that, Bart?" And he'd say, "You stupid." The rest I can't say. It'd be bleeped out and storm off and slam the bathroom door or wherever he was going.
Now, this was completely untypical of him pre-accident, right?
Absolutely. I mean, well, he was a firecracker. He had a temper, but no, it had to be what you would call good cause. And we were strict parents, so we wouldn't have tolerated it pre-accident. But there was really nothing much for it at this stage because, if you know, the stages of coma emergence, he was simply too early. I mean, they send him home. he's not really ready to come home. That's dictated by, broadly speaking, bureaucratic requirements. He should have still been in hospital, but I don't want to complain about that. We had him at home. We weren't prepared. They gave us all kinds of things. Make sure the doors are always locked. Make sure there's an alarm. Make sure the basement door is closed so he doesn't fall down the stairs. He was having trouble with ambulation. I mean, if you saw him, you'd say, well, he's a hospital patient, but he's at home, right? And he's, to speak colloquially, he's out of his frickin' mind, right? He's not at all rational. So, and you asked, how did Cassidy take it? He never turned on Cassidy because he cherished her and adored her always. When he saw her at the airport, when we picked her up in the middle of the winter and she was wrapped in a white robe, he named her then. He had a nickname. She's like a snow angel, and he still uses it. Of course, she's 22 and may not appreciate it so much anymore. But he never turned his ire toward her. But she witnessed this hundreds of times toward us when we got him back in school. And that's a whole nother, I mean, we can touch on it. Maybe we should get
him. Tell us about it.
Okay. So it was a dramatic day. I'll never forget it. I've forgotten most of it, thank God. And I would have never written the book at all. Couldn't have written it except, you know, Vive la Différence. My wife kept a journal. I forgot most of this. And I said, well, I need to write this. I am a writer. And she said, well, I've got the journal. I've got everything. And I said, well, why the hell did you journal it? And she said, well, so Bart would know what he missed. In any event, it's toward the end of day hospital, what they call it. It's a euphemism for going to the hospital for all the therapies. And I was with Bart that day. Dale always went, but I have a full-time day job. But I went that day because I knew they were sending a delegation from the New Paltz High School. And I was president of the New Paltz YMCA at the time. And I, frankly, wanted to use my influence to help Bart get back into school because it was a long shot. So they sent in a couple of people to observe Bart in his classes. Apparently, he was reasonably well-behaved that day. But he did have a flare-up with me so violent just before they came that he had grabbed my arm and dragged me across the lobby of the hospital.
How tall was he at that point?
He's full height, 5'9". He's a big bruiser. I'm black belt. One of your colleagues at SUNY New Paltz was my sabon, Joe Ramos. I don't know if you know him.
Sure.
He's a good guy in art, a lovely guy. Anyway, so I could have broken the hold, but I mean, you know, the kid is he barely walks, he's injured, he's out of his mind, so he really hurt me. I had black and blue marks there for months because he had the one strong arm. His right arm he wasn't using at the time. He went out of his mind. It doesn't matter over what because it doesn't matter. Could have been anything. And then after he settled down a little bit, the delegation comes in. And I said, oh, geez, we're well and truly screwed.
This isn't good.
It ain't good. So they come to me afterwards and they say, I knew them. I knew who they were. They knew me. They said, well, you don't really want him back in the classroom, do you? And I sort of lost it. I said, you're damn well right. I want him in the classroom with people who know and love him, surrounded by people he cares about and care about him. He hates this frickin' place. He hates it. And he won't make any progress, and he hardly did. The recommendation of the hospital was that he be placed in a convalescent home or a nursing home. That was it. He wasn't
a nursing home.
Yeah, he wasn't meeting any of his
meaning
goals.
Meaning it's over.
Basically, he wasn't meeting any of his goals. They had a whole sheet of goals. He met none of them in the hospital or in the day hospital. And the people, I don't know exactly what the educators saw or thought, but they didn't think he could make it, even in special ed. So a long campaign to get him into special ed. We got him in. This is 9 months after the accident, so it's the fall of 2002.
But it was your right as parents
to have this. We have an IEP. We got very good advice from a professor, Jan Stivers. I don't know if you know her over in Marist, but she's a professor of special ed, and she has Korean kids. So there's another kind of fellowship of sorts with the adopted families. So she helped us, and she advised us, and they formed the committee, and we were represented. We got what's called a coordinator, a Medicaid coordinator, and we got him in. But it was very tentative. They said, we'll give you one semester. If he can't make it even with a full-time one-on-one aid and in special ed, then he's out. So it didn't look like he was going to make it. For one thing, he had we used to call it narcolepsy. It wasn't, but he would fall asleep about every half hour. sometimes every 20 minutes. And mid-sentence, he'd just put his head down, he'd be gone. And the classes were 80-minute classes at New Paltz High, double classes. So he wasn't making it through the classes. And that's really, that's the point at which the whole story changed. We were casting about because we began to realize, we didn't know till then. I always thought the doctors would figure this out, he'd get better, you know, and they sort of talked that way. But by then we realized that he'd plateaued more or less and he was going nowhere fast. And while we kept him out of the convalescent home, it was miserable. Just taking him to school was miserable. He hated school because he wasn't with his friends. He was with what he called the retards. I know it's the wrong word, but I'm telling you what he would say. And, you know, it was a terrible burden on everyone, especially him, to go to school and to have an aide with him like he's a baby. He had awareness of those things. The social element he was well aware of.
Who, besides Marist, were you getting help from? Did you have to pay social workers? I mean, who helped you?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we came up with another concept that we're very fond of. We call it the conspiracy of decency. We didn't pay anybody. Well, I mean, we would have, and we could have afforded to, but we didn't. I was well known through my work at the Y. Bart was extremely well known. He was point guard on the basketball team. He was a character at school. People came forward and helped. So,
like what?
The first one, and the one that the concept sprung up from him, Coach William DeFino, who had been Bart's coach since kindergarten, right? And then Bart had gone up through the schools, and so had the coach. The coach was now varsity basketball and football
at the high school.
At the high school, and he came to us right away. He visited Bart in hospital. So did Coach Tegla. I mean, those people are wonderful. They're salt of the earth. So that he came to us rapidly after Bart was in school. Now Bart could not even dribble a ball or reach the hoop. He was just enervated. This is common. He had what we'll call brain fatigue. I'm saying he's going to sleep every 20 minutes, right? So. Coach D, as he's known, came up to me and said, well, I'll work with Bart on Fridays after school on his basketball skills. I said, oh, thank God. I mean, that would be great. I said, you know, he says, I know. I have him in gym. I know where he's at. And he refused payment. And I argued long and hard because he's a young guy and he has young kids. I said, this is nonsense. You take it, put it aside for your kids. No. He said, man, it's my way or the highway, Joel. You know, take it or leave it. I said, well, I'll take it. And then another guy, Duffy Violante, who we knew, he's an old friend of ours, a family friend. He's a licensed massage therapist and a nurse, and he'd been a corpsman in Vietnam. He's done all kinds of healing. And he said, well, look, I'm going to give Bart craniosacral therapy, which is a kind of light massage. I won't go into the details of it now, but it's especially good for central nervous system issues. Okay. They did that every week for years and wouldn't take any money. He just said, look, it's such a crushing injury, I can't take it. My wife, of course, is a Reiki master, and she was giving him Reiki treatments from the first day.
What is Reiki again?
It's energy healing. I think of it as faith healing, you know, along those lines. It certainly works. I have a chronic back, and it works great for me. So it's something like light energy work. It's an ancient Japanese healing.
Okay.
So there were a number of these people, and there was Jan Stivers. They're in the book. Is like 80 of them. People came and wanted to help. They wouldn't take payment, so there was no payment involved. But, of course, you move toward therapies and modalities where you have to pay. So Bart was cruising to be thrown out of school, right, because he couldn't stay awake. And a friend of ours, Michael Compain, part of this conspiracy of decency, a doctor in this case, but not one that we see as a doctor. He's a friend, a real friend. I would never see him as a doc. Ruin the friendship. He suggested something called hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And he used it for his patients. His patients, he treats mostly autistic kids. He's down in Rhinebeck. And he said, you know, it's helping them. And I don't see how it could hurt.
What is it?
It is exactly what you used to see in the old movies, and I'm sure you've seen it several times, Lloyd Bridges and so
on.
Well,
I'm old.
They go in, well, like me. You're a kid. I'll call you a kid. They go into this thing, and it's a diving bell, and they are given pure oxygen, 100% really? Oxygen, under pressure. Really? Now, if you think about this airwood, it's like 19% oxygen. That's 100%, and this is no pressure. That's at the equivalent of about 16 to 20 feet. And what happens briefly is, and this is well established, this part isn't controversial, the body's ability to absorb air, oxygen, and the red blood cells pick it up and take it throughout the body. But under the kind of pressure we're talking about, that mechanism is overwhelmed. And all of the body's fluids, all of them, everything that's fluid, and we're mostly fluid, becomes super saturated with oxygen. Now the explanation becomes a little more speculative, but less and less as the research goes on. That oxygen goes to the site of the injury, causes revascularization. So now blood can get in, and it can bring the healing elements that are required, and it can get rid of the toxins. And the gist of it is that it begins. Now, I should say this, and this is well worth noting, that hyperbaric oxygen is an approved FDA therapy for a whole range of ills. If you, God forbid, get a third-degree burn, you're in an oxygen chamber, pronto. If you start losing your feet because you've got diabetes, you're in an oxygen chamber. There's a long list of what it's approved for. TBI is not.
Joel, I'm so sorry. Yeah. Were you checking with some central medical figure every time you made a decision like this?
No, but we did form, and this is one of the key points of the book. This is one of the reasons we're here. We formed what we called the board. Michael Compain was on it, and there were three other doctors, including the neurosurgeon. Now, they didn't know there was a board or that they served on it, but they functioned as a board. We called each one of them. We'd say, hello, doc, we're thinking, and we did. We called the surgeon. I remember what he said precisely. We're thinking of using hyperbaric oxygen therapy for Bart because he can't stay awake, and we don't know what else to do. And he said, well, you know, I don't know much about it, but I don't see how it could hurt. That was it. That's the answer we needed. We used the Hippocratic test of do no harm. If all four cleared it, in most cases we tried it. There was some more vetting.
What if one said no?
We didn't do it. There really? Was one. I was so set to do it that there was a neurologist, a board-certified neurologist in Florida, and he was doing something with pharmaceuticals. He was giving meds that allegedly opened up the venous system so you could get better blood flow. And I'd been reading about him and learning about him, all about the internet. I already checked with my brother. He was going to put Bart and I up for a month. He lives down there. And then one of the four came back and said, whoa, wait a minute. You know, I'm looking at the drugs the guy's using, and none of the things that we ended up using involved drugs at all. Mm-hmm. He said, yes, they will open up all of the veins and arteries, but there is a fair chance, a decent chance, not a marginal chance, that in so doing it will only further starve the injured parts. He gave some medical term that the healthy parts starve the dwarf parts. And he said, so the chances of injury is significant. So we got skunked. We didn't do it. So one was enough to knock it out. We needed all of them. But, you know, some of the things we did, we did something called vision restoration therapy. Bart was half blind. 50% of his field of vision was gone.
Wow.
It's called hemianopsia. It's very common. 15 to 18% of stroke and traumatic brain injury victims suffer from it. And this really galled me. There is no treatment. It's an intractable condition. And there's a whole, that's a theme, a leitmotif in the book. What are we going to do? Bart can't see. And we eventually found a partial solution for that at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital.
What was that?
That's called Nova Vision Vision Restoration Therapy. At the time, it was an experiment when we did it. Now it's a commercial product. You can buy it. We had to pay for it at the time.
Well, what was it?
Oh, it is a computer program that's monitored by the company. They map the field of vision. So Bart was 50% blind. I know we don't have viewers, but if you imagine the full right side of your field of vision in both eyes is blind because his eyes were fine. It was the occipital lobe where it's all processed that was injured. So he has no vision there, and they map it, and they can show it to you. And any low vision specialist can do that much, and then that's the end of the story, except with Nova Vision, they worked up a program where you play a game, and there are lights going on and off, and every time you see a light, you gotta hit the mouse, and they purposely format it so they work along the periphery of the blindness. And don't you know, gradually the field expanded. His expanded from 50% to 59%, which may not seem like much, but it was like second coming news in science and for us. It changed. He hasn't practically bumped into anything since, because that extra roughly 20% expansion, 10% more of the total
on
field.
On each side.
Yeah. Off to the right. He was blind to the right, so it was always on the right in both eyes. He's able to see where his feet are. He's able to read a book across the page. It used to white out about three quarters of the way out. But again, if you do the geometry, at this distance, the extra 10% allows you to scan the page. So he reads now, and he reads it at grade level, at college level.
Okay, so all of this happened over a period of how long?
Well, the what I'll call the heavy use of alternate therapies went on for about 4 to 5 years. Because for one thing, there is no encyclopedia. There is no guru. There's not. You can't just go and say, well, what can we do?
You're just figuring this out for yourselves.
We cobbled it together. We cobbled the board. Most of the board, all but Michael Compain, don't believe in alternative therapies. So they weren't a source. I mean, there's one of them who warned me. I'll never forget his response to it. He said, well, sure, but it won't do any harm. But not all who rave are divinely inspired. Some are just lunatics. And that was his attitude toward all the therapies. Which took Bart. Bart's not in a nursing home or convalescent home. He lives in his own apartment in Del Mar. He has a part-time job. He has friends. He can't drive because of the vision limitation. And he still has significant deficits in short-term memory, fine motor.
How about a thing?
No, that's under control. But that only it gradually reduced, but you still had terrible flare-ups. Flare-ups that if you witnessed it, you'd say somebody was having a psychotic episode if you didn't know. So when you see homeless guys and former veterans, you think they're psychotic. Many of them just have traumatic brain injury and they're suffering from that. He stopped having uncontrolled outbursts after about 9.5 to 10 years, and we noticed what was happening. And I asked him outright, why? I mean, because by then, you talk to him. If you guys met him now, you'd figure out that there was something wrong, but it would take you a long while. You'd figure it out because you'd notice after an hour or two, you'd say, well, geez, didn't I say I'm not a Yankee fan? His short-term memory is sketchy, all right? And there are some other issues. You notice he's wearing funky glasses with huge prisms that slightly expand his field of vision. He stopped. The frequency of irrational outbursts went down after about 8 years. And I asked him at the time, I said, how come you're not coming out of your skin at us so much? He says, well, I'm not an adolescent anymore. And so I don't have those hormones. And that was true. But eventually he stopped having those episodes because he made new friends. You know, one of the universals. And it's a big theme in the book, but if I were writing it again now, it wouldn't be such a big theme, because I've come to understand it since writing it. All his friends dropped him. They moved on with their lives. And that caused me to be very angry, too. But, you know, as I say, I'm closer to the end of this journey than to the beginning. He's a kid. He was furious. He was furious, and he couldn't let it go. And he couldn't let the friends go. The term they use, it's an ugly term, but it's an ugly thing. Perseveration. People who have brain injuries, the negative things stick to them like lint on a sweater, and they keep coming back. And I've asked neuropsychs, why? And he says, it's the nature of memory that the really negative, horrible things, they'll stick even in a very damaged brain. Whereas the routine things like, how does it feel to sit in this chair? You know, they don't even get him imprinted to begin with.
And how much education did he finish with?
Well, he finished high school.
Really?
Yeah, he did. I mean, not on time. 2 extra years. All that we paid for. We paid for all kinds of tutoring, right? It was a struggle and a half. But one of the things, you know, Bart is a riot. I said he was the class clown. We all have a good sense of humor. So, you know, we made the best of it. I mean, when he graduated, he beat Bellucci's record in Animal House, you know, wasting 7 years in college before getting thrown out. So Bart spent quite a few years at that high school. He graduated. He wanted to. This was a very long shot again, oh my. But we did what we could. I thought it would take a near miracle. But he went for one semester to Maria College and stayed in the dorm and everything. and even passed a class or two. But it was too hard. It was too hard academically, and it was too hard. You think about the challenges a freshman faces and anyone going away to a sleepaway college, and now imagine that you have anger issues that weren't just with us. I mean, his friends dropped him, but I'm sure a piece of that is that they found him very difficult to deal with, you know.
Do you remember the day he graduated?
Yeah, I remember graduation.
What was that like? Day.
Well, he was clowning around as usual. He was in a fine mood, and he had one local friend, not in the car, and I think that's important. I'm guessing that that's why that friend managed to stand by Bart during those four grim years. So the one friend from prior to the accident, Doug Bogans, great man, came to graduation, and we had friends of the family, of course. We were all there, and we went out to a festive Italian dinner afterwards, and Bart was in a great mood. And see, he would have been entitled under the law to stay in high school another year, and all the experts, and I'll consider myself a lay expert, we all thought he should stay another year because he was making good progress, and there was still a long way to go, but hell, he was 20, and he'd watched his friends graduate in 03. The younger kids who he'd played basketball with, after all, he was on varsity, graduate in 04, and now it's 05, and he was saying to us, he said, Dad, I'm not going to be in this high school another year.
Could he do sports?
Well, here's the irony, Alan. He can do them, but he was athletic, right? He played soccer, baseball, and basketball for the schools. So the way he plays them now, they're saying the excellent is the enemy of the good. He just won't play because he used to do the between the leg things and all of that. Now, he's still blind roughly 40% of the field of vision, and his right side motor coordination, even with extensive occupational therapy, never really fully returned. It only returned about 50%. So he just doesn't play because when I'll challenge him, I don't even bother anymore, but I did for many, many years. We'll go out and we'll go to Jettos in Kingston and hit some balls. He can do that. Coach D's taught him to do that. No one, including us, I didn't think that Bart could hit a ball because he has no depth perception. He doesn't have depth perception. So how are you going to hit a ball? Coach D said he could do it. He can do it. He's compensated. The brain is more plastic than we thought. The Nova Vision proved that. And Bart, in his own small way, has contributed to the science of brain science because his doctor at Columbia, who is Dr. Randolph Marshall, proved... He's not the only one, but he is one of the main ones. Prove the theory of brain plasticity. That is, that new cells that had never seen before, they were on the periphery of the visual cortex, they could learn to see. And that's a big deal. And that's as big a deal for brain science as, say, the invention of open heart surgery was for heart scientists. So Bart's name is in the congressional record, Randy Redden. He's very sweet of him.
We only have a couple of minutes left, so I want to ask you very quickly what you think in terms of the organization of people who have had similar experiences. In other words, what should be done? Have you ever thought of running such an organization? What happens?
Okay. There are some very good groups. I mean, we need to have more of a grassroots organization. My wife and I have talked about it. You know, I'm getting a little old. I was the first president of the Y in New Paltz. I, under Jack Young's leadership in Kingston, we started that Y, and I did some work with the adopted kids. But I'm getting a little older, and whatever they say about the mid-60s being like the 40s,
well,
it's not the same. I'll be 64.
You're a young kid.
Oh, okay. Well, that's very, very sweet of you, Alan. You know.
Well, compared to 71, you're young.
Oh, okay. All right. So you can call me kid, it turns out. I don't really feel like I might do it but I'm still a working stiff. I work, you know, I have a full-time job. Mm-hmm. I'm still involved with the Y. I'm involved again. It took about 7 or 8 years to get back. So there are groups, and I think they can form the core of the beginning of a movement. You know, every state has a brain injury association, and the New York State one is a good one. So every state has a brain injury association. the military experience, you know, traumatic brain injury is the defining injury from the wars. There's somewhere between, it's a widespread, but somewhere between 300 and 600,000 TBIs, depending upon what reliable source you use. That, by the way, is way too many. I know the system that's in place to take care of them. There is no way to take care of them. That's why the alternative therapies, which are very cheap and they're harmless, they've been vetted, and they're easy to train people to use. It's not like creating neuroscientists or physical therapists, and they're easily scalable. It's another time, another talk, but I've thought through, not that I have no illusions of grandeur that they're going to listen to me, but if I win the lottery, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
You could put in place 300 combined brain treatment centers offering hyperbaric oxygen and craniosacral therapy in already existing VA facilities around the country, and you could treat all of these guys and gals, all of them. Take a couple of years if you work the numbers. And then that could migrate to the general population. If you're talking about groups now that people want to get involved in that are really doing good work, I can name a few that are the best in breed. Oh, best in breed. There's an outfit called Remind.org. That's the Woodruff Family Foundation, Lee Woodruff, who wrote the foreword to the book. She was gracious enough to do that. And Bob Woodruff. They do incredible work. And all the money goes not to vets directly, but to vet-oriented organizations that deal specifically with TBI and that are on the ground around the country, and most importantly, many of which are open to alternatives. I should say this, I want to say this. I don't advocate in the book that everybody should drop everything and use the therapies that I used or that we used. That's not the idea. The idea is to take up this sad burden and figure out what therapies, you know, map your son or daughter's injury and figure out what's going to work and push this thing forward. We've learned a very effective new therapy since we wrote the book, and we're about to start some with Bart. So Remind.org, terrific for vets. There's a group, an organization called Brainline. Brainline.org. They're owned by PBS down in D.C., WETA, I think. They own them, and also the VA is involved. Tremendous resource of all kind, including for networking. It's going to take something like, you know, I think this is what happened with Autism Speaks. You're going to need a wealthy patron, somebody's going to have to come around and say, all right, look, I'm going to foot the bill for this. I could help organize that in a snap, but I'm not offering myself. I'm trying to, I'm on a mission, and that the mission is to make people aware that this terrible injury, which most people eventually just beats them up and they say, enough, you know, no mas, that you can make progress against it.
Do you ever think about why me?
No, I don't. You know, I sort of try to address it in the book, but there's no answer. I believe in God, but I don't think that God is behind every little thing that happens. Every time a bee flies in somebody's car and he slams into a tree because of that, that God said, "You see, I got you." I think there's a certain amount of randomness out there, and we have to make do with it and make our way, and God helps those that help themselves. And the program that we talk about in the book is how to help yourself.
The book, of course, is No Stone Unturned, a father's memoir of his son's encounter with traumatic brain injury. Joel Goldstein is the author. Joel, I thank you so much for coming in and spending an hour with us. It really is a terrific story, and you had me wet behind the eyes at least a few times here. So thank you so much for doing it and for being with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, and I love AMC. Thank you so much.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.